human race from extinction. As quickly as it had come, the memory ended, and Desmond was back in the taxi in Berlin, the city flying by in a blur. Desmond desperately needed to figure out his next move. He needed information, especially about the local area. He drew a 20-euro note from his pocket and slipped it past the clear plastic security barrier. "I wonder if you'd be willing to tell me a bit about Berlin. It's my first time here." The driver seemed hesitant at first, but finally began to speak. Driving through the crowded streets, the elderly man spoke with great pride, describing a city that had played a pivotal role in European history for almost 1,000 years. Desmond asked him to discuss the city's layout. Anything remarkable about getting in and out, and the major districts and neighborhoods? The man was wound up now, talking almost without pause, and didn't seem to mind the direction. Berlin was a sprawling city that covered over 340 square miles, larger than New York City, and 9 times the size of Paris. It was also one of the German Republic's 16 federal states. Berlin had 12 boroughs, or districts. Each was governed by a council of 5 and a mayor. Desmond counted it all as good news. Berlin was a big city, which made it a good place to hide. The driver told him that Berlin's new Hauptbahnhof was now the largest train station in Europe, and that the city also had several rivers and over 1,700 bridges, more than Venice. Boat tours were common, and many places in the city could be accessed by boat. Desmond asked about tourism. The driver, who had lived in East Berlin until the wall fell in 1989, was happy to report that Berlin was currently the most popular tourist destination in Germany, and one of the top 3 in Europe. During the previous year, nearly 30 million people had visited Berlin, which had only 3.5 million permanent residents. The influx of tourists had put a strain on the city's housing market, making it tough for Berliners to find a decent apartment to rent. Many estate agents and other enterprising individuals were now signing annual leases on apartments simply to sublet them to tourists on sites like Airbnb. In fact, the city's Senate had recently passed a law requiring renters to notify their landlord if they were subletting. Still, nearly 2/3 of the 12,000 apartments for sublet were unregistered and operated illegally. Desmond turned the facts over in his mind, a plan forming. From his pocket, he took out the only clue he had about who he was: the coupon for the dry cleaner. He considered asking the driver to take him there, but he knew it was only a matter of time before the police found the elderly man and learned where he had dropped Desmond off. He needed to make his trail disappear. "What's Berlin's busiest tourist attraction?" "The Brandenburg Gate," the driver said. "Or perhaps the Reichstag. They're next to each other, so it makes no matter. Drop me there, would you?" 15 minutes later, Desmond paid the driver and exited the cab. "Be careful," the older man said before welcoming a new fare and driving away. From the Brandenburg Gate, Desmond strolled quickly into the Großen Tiergarten, Berlin's oldest park, and at 520 acres, one of the largest urban parks in Germany. It had once been the private hunting reserve for Berlin's elite, and it retained much of that untouched character. Desmond moved along its walking trails before exiting the park on Tiergartenstrasse, where he hailed a rickshaw. He rode for 20 minutes, until he saw another rickshaw unloading its passenger. He stopped the driver, who seemed to never tire, paid him, and hopped into the other rickshaw. He did the change once more, then got in a cab and showed the driver the coupon from Quality Dry Cleaning for less. "Do you know where this address is?" The driver nodded. "It's in Wedding, in Mitte." "Where's that?" "In the center of the city." "Perfect. Let's go there." 20 minutes later, Desmond stood outside the dry cleaner, which was a narrow store with a plate glass facade. The buildings along the street were run down, but the area was bustling. The sidewalk swarmed with younger people and immigrants from around the world. A cloud of cigarette smoke hung in the air above them, and farther up, satellite dishes lined the roofs. Through open second-story windows, Desmond could hear radio and TV shows in foreign languages, Arabic and Turkish, he thought. Behind the counter in the dry cleaner, he found a short, bald Asian man with round glasses sewing a shirt. The shopkeeper set down his needle and thread, got off his stool, and nodded once at Desmond.
"I need to pick up.
Tag?"
"I don't have a tag."
The man slid over to a keyboard and monitor on the counter.
Name?
Desmond Hughes, he spelled it. As he typed, the shopkeeper said, ID? Desmond stood silently, contemplating what to do. The shopkeeper eyed him.
No ID, no pickup.
Desmond held up the police ID he'd taken from the officer in his hotel room. This is a police investigation. We're looking for Desmond Hughes. The Asian man raised his hand slightly.
Okay, okay.
The shopkeeper repeated the name, spelling out each letter deliberately as he finished typing the name. He shook his head.
That's nothing. No Desmond Hughes.
Desmond wondered if he had misread the clue. Maybe he was supposed to meet someone here, not pick up his dry cleaning.
How many people work here?
That seemed to scare the man.
No one, only me.
Look, this has nothing to do with your business or employees. Is there someone else in the back I can talk to?
No, no one.
Desmond glanced behind him, out the large front window, just in time to see a police patrol car roll by. He turned, waiting for it to pass. He wouldn't get anything else from the dry cleaner. Maybe it was just a random coupon, and had nothing to do with who he was or what was going on. Finally, he said,
Okay, thank you. You've been very helpful.
On the street, he moved with the throngs of people, trying to stay out of the line of sight of cars passing by. Two blocks from the dry cleaner, he spotted a mobile phone store, where he bought a disposable smartphone. They were common in Europe. Tourists and temporary workers often used them to avoid roaming charges for calls and data. The phone and a prepaid GSM SIM card severely depleted his cash supply. Money would become a real problem soon. He made a note to use only the mobile data in an emergency until he solved his cash problem. He bought a doner kebab from a street vendor, wolfed it down, and slipped into a crowded coffee shop with free Wi-Fi. He locked himself in the single toilet bathroom, ensuring no security cameras could see his actions or record his conversations. His first instinct was to search the internet for himself, to dig into the mystery of who he was, and to look up Peyton Shaw. But he had to cover the bases of survival first. He needed to get off the street as soon as possible. The cab driver was right. There were tons of flats and rooms for rent on a nightly basis in Berlin, but many of the listing sites, like Airbnb, required him to register and pay with a credit card in order to rent. That wouldn't work. He found a site that required landlords to pay to list and began bookmarking suitable accommodations. Luckily, there were quite a few studio flats available in vetting. Most were run down, but they were cheap. He dialed the number listed for a promising flat nearby. Without thinking about it, he spoke excitedly with a New England accent far different from his neutral Midwestern accent.
Oh, hi. Do you have the flat for rent on Amsterdamer Strasse?
Yes, that is correct.
The woman's voice held little emotion.
Is it available for the next 3 days?
Yes.
Wonderful, wonderful. Listen, I'm in Berlin for business and I could really use some help. I took the train in and when I woke up, it was all gone. I mean, everything. My luggage, laptop, wallet, passport, money, credit cards, you name it, gone. The rascals even slipped my wedding ring off.
Oh, that's terrible, the woman said with a little more sympathy.
My wife wired me some money and I'm looking for a place to rent. Can we meet? You'll see I've got an honest face.
Desmond let out a goofy, nervous laugh that matched the fake, exasperated accent he had affected.
Ah, well, okay.
The woman said it would be 3 hours before she could get to the flat. Desmond agreed and ended the call. Assuming it worked out, he'd be off the street soon. He opened a web browser and scanned the top German news sources. Bild carried no news about him, but a breaking news banner at the top of Spiegel Online read, Berlin police launch citywide manhunt for American man wanted for murder and assaulting two police officers. Desmond clicked the link and scanned the article. The hunt was being run by the Landeskriminalamt, also known as the LKA, the police division charged with investigating major crimes and conducting special manhunts. The LKA would be coordinating a number of units. Reading the list gave Desmond pause about staying in the city. The Spezialeinsatzkommando, the state police's SWAT teams, were on standby for locations to raid. Mobils Einsatzkommando, the special operative agents of the LKA, were being deployed to every borough to conduct a manhunt. Wasserschutzpolizei, the river police, were monitoring all the city's waterways. Zentraler Verkehrdienst,
the traffic police, had engaged local and highway patrol units, Autobahnpolizei, to search for him. They even had Diensthundführer, canine units, at the Concorde picking up his scent. They were about to turn the city upside down looking for him. Despite naming him, the article didn't have any details about who he was or his background. This was both a relief and a disappointment. It would make it harder for them to find him, but it told him nothing about who he was. Desmond opened the phone's map application and found what he needed. Despite the citywide manhunt launching, Wedding looked like it would be a perfect place to hide. But Desmond still had the sense that he was missing something, and that the dry cleaner was somehow part of the puzzle. 3 blocks away, Desmond sat in the changing room of a second-hand thrift shop. 2 outfits hung on the inside of the door, both Turkish-made and more casual than his button-up shirt and khakis. When he slipped his pants off, what he saw took his breath away. Burn scars spread from his feet to his knees. The mottled flesh looked like creamy white tree roots growing across his body. They were old scars, remnants of a horrible event. The feeling was unnerving, not being able to remember the fire that had torched his legs. He searched the rest of his body. Above his pelvis on the right side, he found a puckered, rounded scar below his ribs. A healed gunshot wound? Scattered about his torso and arms were smaller, straight scars where knife wounds had likely healed. In the hotel room, he had been so focused on the aching black and blue bruise on his left side that he hadn't noticed anything else. Now he longed to know where he'd come from, what sort of life he'd led, what sort of person he was, or at least had been. As he stared at the floor, something inside the crumpled-up khaki pants caught his eye. A pink tag stapled to the garment's care instructions. He had seen similar tags before, only hours ago, attached to clear plastic bags hanging in rows in the dry cleaner. He had found the claim tag. He detached it, then carefully searched both the shirt and pants, finding nothing else of interest. He sold the shirt and pants to the thrift shop. He needed the money, and police across the city likely had pictures of him wearing them by now. A sign on the wall claimed all items were thoroughly cleaned before being offered for sale, and he hoped it was true. If not, the police dogs might pick up the scent in the store. With some of his extra money, he purchased a ball cap, sunglasses, and a backpack. In the changing room, he put all his possessions, the extra clothes and the spare magazines for the policeman's gun, in the backpack. 10 minutes later, he once again stood outside the dry cleaner. The older Asian man was gone. A younger man, also Asian, now sat at the counter, hunched over a textbook, a pencil in his hand, scribbling notes. Desmond walked in and slid him the tag without a word. The teenager searched the rows of hanging clothes, checking the tag several times. After a few minutes, he shook his head and returned to the counter. "You're picking up late? There's a fee." "How much?" "3 euros per day." "How late am I?" Desmond was already dangerously low on cash. He had just enough to pay the rent at the crummy flat for 3 days, and he was due to meet the landlord in less than an hour. The teen worked the computer, searching the tag number. 14 days late. 42 euros plus a cleaning. 55 total with tax. If he paid, Desmond wouldn't have enough for rent for all 3 nights. He considered pulling the police ID again, but that would only invite problems. So he forked the cash over and waited while the teen thrashed around in the back for what felt like an hour. Desmond hoped it would be worth it, that whatever he or someone had stashed here contained something to get him out of the fix he was in. The boy emerged with a plastic hanging bag covering an expensive-looking navy suit. Desmond could barely resist the urge to tear it open and examine it right there. His appointment with the landlord, however, was fast approaching. So with the suit hanging over his shoulder, he made his way to the meeting spot. He found a young woman in her mid-20s, a cigarette in her hand, standing in front of a run-down 3-story building. 4 Middle Eastern teenagers sat on the steps outside the front door, arguing in a language Desmond didn't recognize. "Are you Ingrid?" he asked in the same New England accent he had used before. "Yeah." She put the cigarette out and accepted Desmond's hand when he extended it eagerly. "I'm Peter Wilkinson. We spoke earlier. Thank you so much for meeting me on such short notice." She led him inside, up a winding narrow staircase, and into the flat, which was tiny but clean. It's perfect, Desmond said. Now listen, this suit is literally all they left me with. Guess they didn't know it was mine.
He smiled sheepishly.
I need it for my meeting tomorrow, and... he sighed. I'm running low on cash.
The woman shook her head.
If you can't pay, you simply cannot stay here.
I've got enough for one night. He handed her the folded-up euros. I'll get you the rest.
Ingrid hesitated.
Look, if I can't pay tomorrow, I'll leave, promise. My wife is going to wire me some more money, I promise, okay?
Ingrid glanced away from him.
All right, I'll come back tomorrow with my boyfriend. Please pay or be gone.
No problem. Thank you again.
The moment the door closed, Desmond ripped into the plastic dry cleaning bag and searched the suit. The patch inside the jacket listed the maker as Richard Anderson, 13 Savile Row. He wondered if it was another clue. He ran his fingers over the embroidery and felt a lump. His heart beat faster. There was something sewn inside the suit.
Chapter 7.
At CDC headquarters in Atlanta, Peyton was working on the central mystery in the outbreak in Mandera, the patients. She believed she had just made a breakthrough. The two young Americans had started a non-profit organization called CityForge. Its mission was to help villages grow by giving them funding for infrastructure and mentoring from city leaders in the developed world. CityForge's funding came from individuals who donated via the CityForge website. The investments were treated as municipal bonds, which meant the donors would benefit financially if the villages thrived. Villages used the money to bring electricity, education, better roads, health care, internet, public sanitation, police enforcement, and other vital services to their citizens. As part of the CityForge model, local leaders were trained to film the village's gradual transformation. The videos gave the mentors in the developed world a way to follow the progress of the villages. In almost real time, city council leaders, mayors, police chiefs, and others could see the village's change and could offer guidance. Individual donors could also follow the village's progress, like a reality show, seeing how the money they provided was improving the lives of the current residents and laying the groundwork for generations to come. The CityForge founders had come up with the idea while they were undergraduates at UNC Chapel Hill, and after graduating this past May, they had set out to make their concept a reality. They had spent the summer promoting their startup and raising money from friends, family, and passionate supporters. They used the funds for their trip to Kenya, where they planned to document every stop along the way and identify their first CityForge villages. And for reasons that remained unclear to Peyton, the two boys had made a pact not to shave or cut their hair during the trip. She clicked the supporters page and read the names. Icarus Capital was among the corporate sponsors. She had seen the name before, hours ago, in her apartment. It was Desmond Hughes's investment firm. Was he involved in some way? She thought it was an odd coincidence, but she couldn't think of a way to act on the connection. Even thinking about Desmond rattled her. She fought to stay focused. Another tab on the CityForge site featured a map with every stop the two young men had made. Most included one or more videos of the two Americans touring the village and doing interviews with residents. Mostly they highlighted how infrastructure could change the villagers' lives. For a few of the villages, the videos continued after the two Americans had left. The more recent films had been uploaded by village leaders hoping to attract financial supporters. The trip log was a dream for an epidemiologist. Peyton wondered if one of the videos would show the origin of the outbreak. She might even be able to track its spread. The key to stopping an outbreak was containment. The first step in containment was to isolate anyone who was infected, and the second step was to interview all the infected patients and develop a list of every person they had come into contact with, a process called contact tracing. From those contacts, Peyton and her team would begin a repeating process. They would search for contacts. If the contact was sick, they would isolate them and trace anyone they had come into contact with. If the contact was asymptomatic, they would test them for the disease and typically quarantine them until Peyton and her team could be sure the person was infection-free. For Ebola, that quarantine period was 21 days.
Eventually, when they had no new contacts to trace, they would end up with two groups, infected and quarantined. But contact lists grew quickly. With each passing hour, a pathogen would reach more and more people. Time was of the essence. In most cases, the first few days of an outbreak determined everything after. On a pad, Peyton had written the names of two Americans, Stephen Cobb and Lucas Turner, as well as the British patient, Andrew Blair. Between them, she had drawn a large X. The X was the variable, the unknown, what she needed to find. At some point, the British man had interacted with one or both of the Americans. Either that or all three had a common contact, someone still out there continuing to spread the disease. It was imperative that she find out where each of them had been and whom they'd interacted with. The travel log could be the key to doing that. If Peyton and her team did their job correctly, they'd end up with a contact tree that eventually had a root contact, the first person to contract the disease, often called patient zero, or the index case. That was the on-the-ground detective work, tracing the pathogen to its origin, containing every person it had touched, and either treating the patients or simply waiting for the outbreak to burn itself out. But even with the video travel log, Peyton and her team were going to need a lot of help in Kenya. She picked up her office phone and called Joseph Ruto, head of the CDC's office in Kenya. Ruto was just finishing a late lunch in Nairobi, which was 8 hours ahead of Atlanta. She briefed him on their plans with the caveat that they might change after the morning conference. The man struck her as competent and focused, and she counted that as a very good sign. It was just before 6 a.m. when she hung up. She had been waiting to make the next call. She wanted her people to get as much rest as possible. Sleep might be hard to come by in the coming days. She dialed the EOC's head of watch and requested they contact all of the Epidemiology Intelligence Service agents. "All of them?" the watch officer asked. "Everyone assigned to CDC HQ. Instruct them to be in the building by 7 a.m. for a pre-conference briefing. They need to come packed and prepared to leave in a few hours. If they're deployed, they'll be working either in Nairobi or in the field in rural Kenya. Instruct them to plan accordingly."
Understood, Dr. Shaw.
The EIS program was a 2-year fellowship established at the CDC in 1951. It had begun as a Cold War initiative focused on bioterror. Today, it was one of the most prestigious and sought-after fellowships in applied epidemiology, known for producing the world's best disease detectives. Candidates applying to the program needed to be either a physician with at least a year of clinical experience, a veterinarian, a PhD-level scientist with a background in public health, or a healthcare professional with at least a master's degree in public health. There were currently 160 EIS officers, 70% of whom were women. During their fellowship, EIS officers often worked in the field, on the front lines of outbreaks. During the 2014 Ebola outbreak, every one of the 158 EIS officers deployed. They served in 17 countries, 8 states, Washington, D.C., and the CDC's Emergency Operations Center. During that time, they collectively contributed 6,903 days of service, almost 19 years combined. Peyton hoped for everyone's sake that the current outbreak would be concluded much more quickly. Peyton was the CDC's leading field epidemiologist, and she was also an EIS instructor. She took both jobs very seriously. The EIS officers she was training could well be making the calls during the next major outbreak or leading the first response at the state level or overseas. Alumni from the program included the current CDC director, past and current acting surgeon generals, branch and division leaders across the CDC, and state and local epidemiologists across the country. She hadn't had a chance to work with every fellow in the current class, and this might be a good opportunity. She began browsing through the personnel files, assembling her team. At 7 a.m., Peyton stood at the podium in Auditorium A of Building 19 on the CDC campus. A fourth of the EIS officers were deployed at local and state health offices. They had dialed into the presentation. The officers who worked at CDC HQ were assembled in the room. 120 faces stared down at Peyton. "Good morning. I'm about to brief you on an outbreak of what we believe is a viral hemorrhagic fever in a small town in Kenya. Pay close attention. Some of you will be deployed today. We'll fly to Kenya this afternoon. Others will support our field operations from CDC HQ for now. Depending on how things go, some of you may end up deployed to the field at a later date. Take notes, ask questions, and learn all you can. Your lives may depend on it, and so could someone else's. Okay, here's what we know so far.
Chapter 8. At 8 a.m., the EOC's conference room was overflowing. Employees from several CDC divisions, as well as representatives from the State Department and the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, were on hand. Peyton sat at the table next to Elliot Shapiro. The EIS agents she'd selected for the deployment were in Auditorium A, watching the conference on a projection screen. After introductions, Elliot led a briefing on the current situation. The State Department representative, Derek Richards, spoke next.
From our perspective, this is an outbreak in the worst possible place at the worst possible time. Let's start with some background.
Richards clicked his mouse, and an image of a badly burned building appeared.
August 1998. Truck bombs exploded outside the U.S. embassies in Nairobi, Kenya, and Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. In Nairobi, 213 people died. 4,000 were injured. The attack was linked to Al-Qaeda. In fact, it's what caused the FBI to put bin Laden on the 10 most wanted list for the first time. Less than 2 weeks later, the Clinton administration launched cruise missiles at Sudan and Afghanistan in Operation Infinite Reach. The hit on bin Laden failed. In response, the Taliban renewed their commitment to harbor him, and the rest is history. State decided not to rebuild the embassy that was bombed in Nairobi. We built a new embassy directly across the street from the UN for security purposes. In the years since the Nairobi bombing, the security situation in Kenya has gotten worse. Crime is high everywhere in the country. It's particularly bad in the larger cities. Nairobi, Mombasa, Kisumu, and the coastal resorts. In Nairobi alone, there are 10 carjackings every day. In May 2014, the U.S., U.K., France, and Australia began issuing travel warnings to their citizens in Kenya. The U.S. went further, reducing our staff at the Nairobi embassy. The U.K. closed their consulate in Mombasa. The effects of the travel advisories were devastating to the Kenyan tourism industry. European travel to the country ground to a halt. Our main concern, however, is Al-Shabaab. They're an Islamic terror group based in Somalia, with cells and operatives throughout Kenya. They want to turn Somalia into a fundamentalist Islamic state. They're essentially ISIS in East Africa. They're brutal, organized, and relentless. The African Union has deployed 22,000 troops to Somalia to try to contain them. They're losing.
Richards clicked the mouse again, and a map of Somalia and Kenya appeared. Areas with terrorist activity were highlighted.
In March of 2016, we received intel that Al-Shabaab was planning a large-scale attack on U.S. and African Union forces in the region. The Air Force launched a strike in which manned aircraft and unmanned MQ-9 Reaper drones hit an Al-Shabaab training camp in northern Somalia. We killed about 150 of their fighters, including their number two.
You can have no doubt that Al-Shabaab is looking for any opportunity to retaliate.
American personnel of any kind operating in Kenya will be pursued. For that reason, U.S. Embassy personnel must get express permission when traveling outside Nairobi and in some neighborhoods in the city. Your status as non-combatants is likely to have no effect on Al-Shabaab. In April 2015, they attacked students at Garissa University. They singled out Christians and shot them. They killed 147 people in the attack. Finally, I would like to present the recent decisions of medical and humanitarian organizations I know you respect.
Richards flipped through his papers. He apparently hadn't memorized this part of his presentation.
In May of 2015, Doctors Without Borders evacuated personnel from the Dadaab refugee camp because of security concerns. In total, they evacuated 42 staff members to Nairobi and closed two of their four health posts. In July of 2014, the Peace Corps suspended all activities in Kenya and evacuated all of its personnel because of the security situation.
Richards looked up from the papers and focused on Elliot. His tone was firm, bordering on aggressive.
At State, we realize this is a serious outbreak with the potential to spread. Our official recommendation is that American personnel remain in Nairobi, offering support and coordination from there. The Kenyans and WHO personnel will be at far less risk in the field, and in fact, the presence of American personnel may endanger them. If you decide to venture outside Nairobi, we recommend only doing so with Kenyan military forces that include units with combat experience and heavy artillery at their disposal. We would also advise you to wait until the NRO can position a satellite in geosynchronous orbit with the area you'll be operating in. And we strongly recommend you wait until the Navy can position a vessel with a rapid deployment force within striking distance of your theater of operations.
Peyton shut her lip. She knew the recommendations were prudent, but also that they would take time, especially the request to the National Reconnaissance Office, where bureaucratic red tape was a fact of life.
How long would all that take? Elliot asked. Unknown. DOD would have to advise on the RDF and vessel alignment. We're not privy to their fleet positioning. But it's safe to assume there are suitable vessels in the Gulf of Aden, Arabian Sea, and Indian Ocean. NRO would have to feed in on the SAT requisition. Can you guess? Maybe 72 hours? Richards said. But I would again urge you not to go to Mandera at all. And if you do, to wait. Somalia is a failed state. We haven't had an embassy there since 91. It closed 2 years before the Battle of Mogadishu. That's when the Black Hawk Down incidents took place. Frankly, that's what you'll be looking at if Al-Shabaab militants find you and engage the Kenyan army. We've got a couple hundred U.S. troops at the Mogadishu airport, but I can't comment on whether they'd be able to assist in an emergency. I know CIA has special operators in Somalia, also status unknown.
Elliot looked over at Peyton. They had worked together so long, knew each other so well, that she could sense what he was thinking. She confirmed it with a short nod that silently said, "We both know what we have to do."
"All right," Elliot said. "We'd like to put in the request to the NRO and DOD and expedite them as much as possible. I'll have the director make calls." "You're going to wait?" Richards asked. "No. We're going to deploy to Mandera with all possible haste."
Richards shook his head in disbelief.
Elliot held up his hands. "Look, if we don't stop this outbreak in Mandera, we'll be fighting it in Nairobi and Mombasa and then in Cairo and Johannesburg and Casablanca. If we can't stop it in Africa, we'll be dealing with it here at home, in Atlanta, Chicago, New York, and San Francisco. 72 hours could mean the difference between a local outbreak and a global pandemic, between a dozen deaths and millions. Right now, infected individuals could be boarding buses, trains, and airplanes. We don't know who they are or where they're going. They may well be on their way to infect cities anywhere in the world, cities that aren't on alert, that have no idea that a deadly pathogen has just touched down within its borders. Our only chance of stopping this outbreak is containing it. That has to happen now, not 3 days from now. Our people are among the best trained in the world. They need to be there right now. We're the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We can't control this disease over the phone."
When the conference broke, Peyton spoke privately to the EIS officers she'd selected for deployment. "You heard the security situation. If any of you feel uncomfortable, I need to know now. I'm not going to put anything in your file. I'll select an alternate and never say a word about it." At 1 p.m., Peyton made her way downstairs and walked nervously through the lobby, unsure how many of the officers she'd find waiting for her. Outside, it took her eyes a few seconds to adjust to the sun. When the scene came into focus, she saw every one of the EIS officers she had selected standing in front of the vans, their duffel bags beside them. She nodded at them, and they loaded up and drove to Dobbins Air Reserve Base. Less than an hour later, they were on their way to Nairobi. From a chain-link fence that ringed Dobbins ARB, the man who had been following Peyton watched the Air Force transport lift off. When it was out of sight, he typed a message to his superiors. "Subject is en route to target zone." Chapter 9. In the small flat in Berlin's vetting neighborhood, Desmond carefully cut the stitches that held the patch inside the suit jacket. The Savile Row label fell away, revealing the contents of the secret pocket. 2 prepaid Visa credit cards. The cards were timely, Desmond was almost out of cash, but he'd hoped for more. In particular, he had hoped for some clue about who he was, why he was in Berlin, and most of all, what had happened to him before he'd woken up that morning in the Concord Hotel with no memories. Something about the cards struck him as odd. Each had a small vertical scratch after the 10th number. To the common eye, it might look random, but the fact that both cards had the mark raised his suspicion. Beside the mark on the first card were four smaller scratches. The second card had two small scratches to the right of the vertical line, just above the card numbers. Was it another code? If so, it likely followed the pattern on the dry cleaning coupon. A simple substitution cipher. Add 4 to each of the first 10 digits on the first card, and 2 to the first 10 digits on the second card. 10 numbers formed an American phone number. Desmond drew out the prepaid smartphone and dialed, doing the math for each digit in his head. He listened anxiously as the first droning beep sounded. Another, a third, then voicemail picked up. To his surprise, he heard his own voice. If you've reached this number, you know what to do. If you don't, you'd better figure it out fast. When the beep sounded, Desmond paused, his mind racing. Was the voicemail box a sort of digital dead drop for messages to someone else? Or was he supposed to try to access the voicemail? He decided to do both. It's Desmond. I need help. He almost said his phone number, but stopped. The voicemail could have been hacked by whoever had sent Gunter Thorne to his hotel room, or the police could have found it by now. Revealing his new number might paint a target on his back. The police could trace the number to the nearest cell tower and triangulate his approximate location. He needed a digital dead drop of his own, something public and easy to access. Thinking quickly, he said, "Leave a message on the Berlin Craigslist under Help Wanted, an ad for a tour guide. Use the words Highwayman in your ad. Hurry." The call had left him with more questions than answers. Hoping for those answers, he dialed the phone number from the second credit card and again heard his own voice. "You've reached Labyrinth Reality. If you know us, you know we think talking is the least interesting thing to do with your phone. I mean, come on, you're holding a location-aware computer in your hand. Do something cool with it." At the beep, Desmond ignored his own words, leaving the same message he'd left on the first number. Labyrinth Reality. He did an internet search for the name and found a website for startup. The contact page listed an address in San Francisco and a number that was different from the one he'd just called. He clicked the team page, but he didn't recognize any of the dozen faces. They were all in their 20s or early 30s, several wearing Warby Parker glasses, a few with tattoos. All the pictures were candids, taken during a ping-pong game at their desks, partially covering their faces in the hall. The titles were quirky, and so were the bios. Desmond clicked the investors page and read the firms listed. Seven Bridges Investments, Icarus Capital, Pax Humana Fund, Invisible Sun Securities, and Singularity Consortium. The name seemed familiar, but no concrete memories emerged. Labyrinth Reality's product was a mobile app that was location-aware and could be used for augmented reality. Users held their phones up at certain locations, and the app would reveal a digital layer with pictures and virtual items not visible to the naked eye. The app would also supplement the experience with videos and text related to the location. It was used for corporate scavenger hunts and games as well as geocaching. City tour groups were using it in Chicago and San Francisco. The app was positioned as a platform, enabling game developers, corporations, conference organizers, and individuals to create labyrinth realities to enhance whatever they were doing. A banner at the top of the web page urged him to download the Labyrinth Reality app. He clicked the link and waited while the app downloaded. When he launched it, a dialogue asked if he wanted to join a private labyrinth or the public space. He clicked private, and it prompted him for a passcode. He thought for a moment, then typed in the second phone number he had called, the one that referenced Labyrinth Reality. A message flashed on the screen. "Welcome to the Hall of Shadows Private Labyrinth." Two icons appeared. To the left was a beast with the head of a bull and the body of a man. To the right was a warrior wearing armor and holding a shield and a sword. The text under it asked, "Declare yourself, Minotaur or hero?" Desmond pondered the question. In some form, it had haunted him since he had woken up. What was he? Was he a monster who had killed in that hotel room? He had assaulted the police officers and hotel security guard without hesitation. And he had been good at it. It probably wasn't the first time he had fought for his life and freedom. His scar-ridden body supported that idea. And in the recesses of his mind, somewhere, he knew that he had done bad things, though he couldn't remember them. Yet deep down, he still felt that he was a good person. Or maybe that was just what he wanted to be. The thought brought clarity. He would enter the labyrinth as he wanted himself to be, not as he was or had been. He clicked the hero icon. The screen faded and a box popped up. Searching for entrance. A minute later, the text turned to red and flashed a new message. No entrance found. Continue searching. Theseus, never give up. Desmond wondered what it all meant. He did a series of web searches trying to connect the dots. The labyrinth had first appeared in Greek mythology. Daedalus and his son Icarus had built the labyrinth to hold the half-man, half-beast minotaur that dwelled at its center. Daedalus was a brilliant craftsman and artist, and his design was so ingenious that he himself had almost gotten trapped within his own labyrinth. At that moment, Desmond realized what he had suspected ever since he'd heard his own voice on the voicemail recording. Like Daedalus, he was trapped in a labyrinth that he himself had constructed. But why? Did he have a proverbial minotaur, a beast, or secret he wished to hide from the world, or to protect the world from? Was he the monster he feared? And he realized something else. If he had built this labyrinth, he must have known that at some point he would enter it, that he would lose his memories, either by his own choosing or by someone else's actions. Was the labyrinth an elaborate backup plan? Would it lead him to whatever it was he needed? Would it somehow allow him to get his memories back? He eased himself up and folded the Murphy bed into the wall. That gave him room to pace in the tiny flat, which was no larger than 12 by 20 feet. The wall opposite the bed held a simple kitchen. A counter with a sink, small refrigerator, stove, microwave, and a TV. The bathroom was a wet room without a single square inch to spare. Desmond walked to the window and looked down. It was 6 p.m. and the streets were packed. A layer of cigarette smoke mixed with car, bus, and motorcycle exhaust. The toxic brew drifted up, casting the scene in haze. The sun was low in the late November sky, and it would set soon. He turned around. The flat's owners had attached a large mirror to the underside of the bed frame, and with the Murphy bed folded into the wall, the mirror made the space seem larger. Desmond stared at himself, at his toned, muscular face, at his blonde eyebrow-length hair, at the image of a man who was a complete mystery to him. His appearance wasn't overly remarkable in Berlin. As a fugitive, he would have been far more noticeable in Shanghai or Egypt. But still, he would have to alter his appearance. When night fell, that would be his first task. At the moment, however, he had to unravel what was happening. He couldn't shake the feeling that there was something he needed to be doing. He focused on what he knew. He had set up the phone numbers and left the voicemail greeting, knowing, or perhaps merely hoping, he would find them. The second voicemail greeting had led him to his own private labyrinth. What did the first phone number lead to? His words in the message had taunted him, saying he'd know what to do. What did he know? He figured he must have purchased the prepaid credit cards first, then set up the phone numbers to match the credit card numbers. He did a series of internet searches and discovered that the first three digits of the phone numbers corresponded to Google Voice Lines. The service was free and included an online control panel where users could access voicemail, forward the number to other phone lines, and more. That was it. He could access the voicemail from the Google Voice app. He downloaded it to his cell and tried a few password combinations with no luck. What am I missing? He searched the suit again. But there were no other hidden pockets, nothing of note. He sat on a small wooden chair by the window to think. The plastic dry cleaning bag lay wadded up in the corner of the room. Through the clear layers, Desmond spotted a pink piece of paper stapled to the top. He jumped up, ripped the plastic apart, and examined the small slip. It was a carbon copy of the dry cleaning receipt. The name on the tag was Jacob Lawrence. Desmond grabbed his phone and entered the name as the password on the Google Voice app. To his relief, it worked. The application opened and displayed the voicemail mailbox, which contained three messages, all from the same phone number. The first was dated 2 days before. He clicked it and read the transcript. "I think someone's following me. Not sure. Don't call back. Meet me where we met the first time. Tomorrow, 10 a.m. Desmond clicked the second message, which had been left yesterday at noon. "Where were you? They searched my flat. I'm sure of it. I'm going to the police if you don't call me." The last message was from today, at 11 a.m. "You're all over the news. Did you kill him? Call me or I'm going to the police. I'm serious. I'll tell them everything you told me and everything I know about you. I've given a colleague a folder with all my notes. If something happens to me, it will be in the police's hands within an hour." Desmond's mind raced. Was the person who left these messages an ally or an enemy? One thing was certain. That person knew who he was. He set his phone up to use the Google Voice number and verified that he was connected to the flat's Wi-Fi. He wanted his next call to be routed through Google servers. The number that had left the voicemails had a Berlin extension. He clicked it from the app and listened as it rang. A man's voice answered, speaking in German-accented English.
"What happened?"
"We need to meet," Desmond said.
"No, I want answers, right now. Did you kill that man?"
"No," Desmond said automatically, still unsure if it was true or not.
"Is this connected to the looking glass?"
The looking glass. The words instantly struck a chord. The looking glass. It meant something to him, but he couldn't remember what.
"Are you still there?"
"Yes," Desmond said.
"I'll explain when we meet."
Silence for a long moment, then,
"Someone's following me. I'm staying with a friend. I've told her everything. She's got the recordings of our previous conversations. If it's you, if you search my flat, and if something happens to me, she's going to the authorities."
"I understand. Believe me, I'm not going to hurt you. I'm a victim, too." A pause. Then he spoke with hesitation.
"Where? When?"
Desmond considered a few options. He was exhausted, and he needed to prepare for the meeting. "Tomorrow at noon. The Brandenburg Gate. Stand in the tourist area, holding a sign that says Looking Glass Tours, prices negotiable. Wear a navy peacoat, blue jeans, and a black hat with nothing on it."
"You want to meet in public?"
"It's safer that way. Leave your phone at home. Come alone, unarmed." He snorted, sounding disgusted.
"Says the man wanted for murder."
"Being wanted for murder doesn't mean I'm guilty of murder. You want answers? Meet me tomorrow."
"Fine."
When the line went dead, Desmond began planning the meeting. Every aspect, every possible contingency. If he played his cards right, he might soon know what was going on. Chapter 10. That night, Dr. Alim Kibbet made his rounds at Bandera Referral Hospital, then retreated to his office, where he took off his worn white coat and began writing an email to the Kenyan Ministry of Public Health. "To whom it may concern, the situation here has deteriorated. I again implore you to send help with all possible haste. The American male who arrived here this morning and presented with symptoms of an as-yet unidentified hemorrhagic fever has died. We are ill-equipped to perform an autopsy or handle his remains. I have sealed his room and barred anyone from entering. His passing distressed his companion greatly. More concerning, the young man, who is named Lucas Turner, has developed a fever, most recently recorded at 102. I fear it will continue to climb, and that he will soon develop symptoms similar to his now deceased companion. If so, his fate may well be the same. I have endeavored to keep detailed notes on his progression and have instructed the staff to take pictures on the hour. Frankly, documenting the disease is perhaps the only useful thing I can do. I have also dedicated much of my time to recording the details of the two Americans' travel, including where they visited and whom they talked to. Additionally, I have asked Lucas about his friend's history of symptoms. I believe it will prove quite helpful to epidemiologists investigating this outbreak. I will forward my notes as I have time. The British patient, who was brought in from the airport, remains in critical condition. I'm not optimistic that he will survive the night. Lastly, we face a new crisis here at MCRH. Personnel. I arrived this morning to find that over half of the hospital staff did not report for work. I cannot blame them. As I have said, we are ill-equipped to deal with these patients. I have instructed nurses to wear gowns, boot covers, face masks, goggles, and double gloves, but I fear these measures may prove inadequate, and our supplies of protective equipment will very soon run out. I ask you again. Outside his office, a nurse yelled,
"Dr. Kibbett!"
Seconds later, the door swung open. The man was bent forward, his hands on his knees catching his breath.
"More infected,"
he said between pants. Alim grabbed his coat, and the two men raced down the corridor to triage. Alim stopped in his tracks, taking in the horror. 10 people, all local villagers, all very sick. Sweat and vomit stains covered their clothes. A few stared with yellowed, bloodshot eyes. A nurse drew a thermometer from a man's mouth and turned to Alim.
105?
It had spread to the villages. Alim wondered if help would be too late. For all of them. Chapter 11. When the Air Force transport reached cruising altitude, Peyton stretched out across several chairs, strapped herself in, and slept. She had gotten only 4 hours of sleep the night before, and had been going as hard as she could all day. Still, she set her alarm for only 30 minutes later. She wanted to be fresh, but not groggy for what came next. Perhaps the most valuable skill she'd acquired while working at the CDC was the ability to sleep nearly anywhere. It had taken her years to master the practice. For her, thinking was the greatest enemy of sleep. When she was battling an outbreak, her mind never stopped working. Thinking became a compulsion. But during her second year of fieldwork, she had learned a sleep technique she'd used ever since. When she needed to rest, she closed her eyes, refused to let her mind think, and instead focused on her breathing. She first forced herself to draw her breaths into her belly, allowing her abdomen to expand, not her chest. With each exhalation, she focused on the tip of her nose, where the breath touched as it flowed out of her, and counted the breaths. She rarely got past 40. When her phone alarm buzzed in her pocket, she rose, stretched, and did a few light exercises. She had been given the option of flying on the air ambulance instead of the Air Force transport. She would have been more comfortable there, but she'd wanted to remain with her team. To Peyton, it was a matter of principle. Besides, they had work to do. She had insisted that 3 of the older CDC employees take the seats on the air ambulance. They would be working in Nairobi, in support positions, and all 3 had thanked her for the more comfortable accommodations. Elliot had chosen the Air Force transport as well. It had a large compartment for cargo and a separate area for passengers. The passenger section had 12 rows, each with 5 seats in the center, plus a single row of seats lining each of the right and left walls. At the head of the compartment were 2 narrow openings beside a wide wall that held a whiteboard. Peyton imagined that the whiteboard was routinely used to brief military personnel and hammer out mission details. She was about to do the same. In fact, to an outside observer, the scene might have looked like a U.S. Navy mission briefing. Her audience included men and women dressed in tan service khakis, identical to the uniforms worn by the U.S. Navy, with similar rank insignias. Her troops, however, were not naval officers. They were officers in another uniformed service, one every bit as important. Peyton was a CDC employee, but she was also a commissioned corps officer of the U.S. Public Health Service. The commissioned corps was an elite team of highly skilled health professionals, and one of the United States' 7 uniformed services, the other 6 being the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard, and National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Commissioned Corps. Over 6,000 men and women served in the Public Health Service Commissioned Corps, and they wore uniforms similar to the U.S. Navy's, service dress blues, summer whites, and service khakis. Commissioned Corps officers held the same ranks as the Navy and Coast Guard, ensign to admiral. Commissioned Corps officers served at the EPA, FDA, DOD, NIH, USDA, Coast Guard, CDC, and many other organizations. They were often the first responders during national disasters, and had deployed in response to hurricanes, earthquakes, and outbreaks. In 2001, over 1,000 PHS officers deployed to New York City after the 9/11 attacks. In 2005, in the aftermath of three hurricanes, Katrina, Rita, and Wilma, more than 2,000 PHS officers deployed to set up field hospitals and assist victims. Over 800 commissioned Corps officers worked full-time at the CDC. Visitors often mistook them for Navy officers. Peyton held the rank of full commander in the commissioned Corps. Elliot held the rank of rear admiral. Of the 160 EIS officers, 102 were commissioned Corps officers. The Corps was also well represented in the group sitting before Peyton. Of the 63 men and women present, 51 were commissioned Corps officers. Like Peyton, they dressed in service khakis, the PHSCC insignia on their left lapel, their rank insignia on their right. Peyton pulled her shoulder-length black hair into a ponytail and smoothed out her rumpled uniform. She straightened the silver oak leaf that designated her rank and walked to the whiteboard. 63 faces focused on her. She saw nervousness and excitement, and above all else, trust. Absolute trust in her ability to guide them through the coming deployment, to keep them safe, and to teach them what they needed to know. She felt the weight of their trust and the burden of her duty. She was an epidemiologist, but she considered her most important job to be that of a teacher. As an EIS instructor, it was her job to prepare her students for whatever they might encounter after their fellowship. The men and women who sat before her were the next generation of public health leaders, and one day, one of them would likely be standing where she was, leading a future CDC mission, or a state or city health department, or conducting vital research for the National Institutes of Health. Being a teacher was a role she relished, because it was so important, and because along her own career path she herself had been lucky enough to have good teachers who cared. 15 years ago, Peyton had been sitting in a crowd like this one. She had been one of these faces, and it had been Elliot standing before them, giving a similar talk. She remembered how nervous she was during her first deployment. She still felt a hint of those nerves. Sometimes she wondered if there was a little excitement mixed in. The thrill of the mission, the stakes, the chase to find the origin of the outbreak and stop it before a catastrophe occurred. She had come to live for days like these. Being in the middle of a crisis almost felt more natural to her than the downtime she spent in Atlanta. Since it was a long flight and they would need to adjust to the 8-hour time difference between eastern Kenya and Atlanta, Peyton had decided to divide her briefing into two parts. The first would be background. Information many of the full-time, seasoned CDC personnel knew by heart. Many of the EIS officers did too. But a refresher was prudent, and it was a great way to break the ice. This was the first foreign deployment for many of the officers, and Peyton knew they were nervous. Going over what they already knew would give them a boost of confidence. She grabbed a blue marker from the whiteboard's tray. Okay, let's get started. As you know from the preliminary briefing, we'll be splitting up in Nairobi. 11 of you will be assisting with operations there. The remainder will join me in Mandera and will likely travel to the surrounding areas. However, I want each of you to be versed on our PPE protocol for the deployment, and I want to share some basic background information. We'll cover mission-specific directives once we get closer to landing. She quickly covered their PPE, which included gowns, coveralls, hoods, goggles, boot covers, gloves, and other items used to protect against infectious material. There's a chance that each of you will come into contact with a pathogen in some way. Those of you in Nairobi may be called into the field. First, know that it will be hot inside the suits. Kenya is located in a tropical zone. Nairobi is just 88 miles from the equator. Even though it's November, the midday sun in Kenya will cook you. You'll be sweating before you put your suit on, and you'll sweat even more while wearing it. Second, you'll likely be unnerved by what you see. Some of us never get used to the human suffering we encounter during these deployments. There's nothing wrong with that. You're going to witness people living in poverty and circumstances you may have never seen before. If you feel overwhelmed, it's okay to excuse yourself. Just let a team member know and walk away and take deep breaths. Whatever you do, do not take your suit off. Inspecting and donning your suit is important, but being careful while doffing it is even more important. After you've had contact with patients, you may have virus particles and bacteria on the outside of your suit hood, goggles, gloves, and boots. If you just rip any part of your PPE off, you're putting your life at risk. When it comes to removing your suit, take your time. It won't be easy. 1 hour is about all anyone can stand in the suits in this kind of heat. By the end of that hour, you'll be dying to get free. But again, take your time. Your life depends on it. Okay, what's our deployment goal here? Anybody? The EIS agents, most in their late 20s or early 30s, sat near the front. The permanent CDC staff on the mission were a bit older, and most had deployed for a dozen outbreaks before. They sat toward the back and kept quiet during the Q&A, giving the EIS officers the opportunity to answer and learn. In the second row, a woman named Hannah Watson answered. Her strawberry blonde hair was tied in a ponytail, and like Peyton, she wore commissioned Corps service khakis. Containment and treatment. Good. Peyton wrote the words in large block letters on the whiteboard. What else? Identification? Millen Thomas called out. He was a veterinarian of Indian descent, sitting several rows behind Hannah. Peyton nodded as she wrote the word on the board. Yes, it would be nice at some point to know exactly what we're dealing with here. What else? An EIS officer in plain clothes called out, Capacity building. Very good. We are here to identify, treat, and contain this disease, but we're also here to help the Kenyans develop their own capacity to stop outbreaks. The CDC has poured millions of dollars into Kenya with the hope of developing a disease detection and surveillance system, as well as native capability to respond to outbreaks. In the battle against pandemics, Peyton continued, we have only one hope, and that's to stop outbreaks where they start. To do that, we need to enable the Kenyans. For those of us in the field, it means training the Kenyan field epidemiologists. In Nairobi, that means giving the staff in the Ministry of Health and their EOC the support and training they need. Okay. Peyton turned back to the board and circled the word identification. How do we identify? Lab tests? A black-haired girl called out. Yes. We have a field test for Ebola. The Re-Ebov antigen rapid test kit. Re-Ebov will give us a result in about 15 minutes. Accuracy is 92% for those infected and about 85% for those negative. What else? Symptoms. Disease progression, a black man in the front row said. Correct. If we can establish a consistent pattern of symptoms, we can make a pretty good guess about what we're dealing with. We'll be taking patient histories from multiple locations. In Nairobi, your job will be to take all those data points and establish a clear pattern. We're looking for trends and commonalities. Now, assuming this is Ebola, what are the symptoms? Voices across the group called out. High fever, severe headache, diarrhea, vomiting, stomach pain, fatigue and weakness, bleeding, bruising. Peyton wrote quickly. Good. The patients at Mandera presented with most of these symptoms.